Risky Business, your weekly security briefing with Patrick Gray. Updating Tuesdays on itradio.com.au.
Hello and welcome to the show, sponsored this week by Tenable Network Security, makers of fine security information event management and security scanning software. Their SIM stuff plugs into all sorts of gear, and their Nessus software is, it's Nessus. It's good stuff. You all know it. You all love it. Unfortunately, there's no news segment this week. I'm travelling at the moment and just couldn't make it happen, so this is a pre-recorded show. But the good news is we've still put together a cracker program for you. In this week's feature interview, we'll talk to Paul Craig, a Kiwi penetration tester and security researcher. Paul's just launched a new tool at DEF CON, and in a minute he'll tell us about it. It's called ICAT. It's pretty cool stuff, actually. Tenable Network Security CSO and industry fixture Marcus Ranham will also join us in this week's sponsor interview. And this week we're talking to Marcus about PCI DSS. It might surprise you to hear this, given Marcus's track record as a cynic, but he actually says the payment card industry data security standard is the single most important thing to happen to the information security industry in its history. That interview is coming up later. But first up, it's time to speak to Paul Craig about kiosk hacking. We've all seen internet kiosks in airports, shopping centres, and even in corporate lobbies. Paul thought it might be a fun idea to have a look at how to bypass the security controls on kiosk software, the controls that are designed to stop the user taking over the machine. And the result of that is ICAT, the Interactive Kiosk Attack Tool, which Paul just launched at DEF CON. It's a set of scripts that you can install on a web server somewhere, and then you point the kiosk's browser at the ICAT site that you've set up, and away you go. You can pwn the kiosk. It's heaps of fun. ICAT was first unveiled at the KiwiCon security conference last year, but since then, Paul's put a lot of effort into improving it.
So about 12, 14 months ago, I was sitting in an airport, and I saw an internet kiosk terminal. And I looked at this kiosk terminal, and I was like, wow, that's pretty cool. I've always seen these around, but I've never really thought about them before. And I noticed there are actually quite a few people waiting to use this kiosk terminal. So I thought to myself, I wonder if I can hack this kiosk terminal. I wonder if I can compromise it and install a keylogger. I wonder if I can set Goatsy as the background. I wonder if I can do something malicious and kill some time during my painful stopovers. So I began sort of thinking about kiosks, and I began to realize that there are actually very few security publications that focus on kiosks. Mm. There are no release white papers. You very rarely see a publication or anything relating to internet kiosk software. It seems to be something that's everywhere in our world, but no one really seems to be hacking it. So I thought, well, hell, I should hack it. I should try and make myself become the king of internet kiosk hacking. I want to be the master kiosk hacker. And I want to be able to walk into any airport and pwn every single kiosk. So I got back home and I started investigating commercial kiosk software. Now basically, the commercial kiosk software market is absolutely huge. It's a multi-million dollar industry.
Well, I suppose that's because you're giving people something that's going to earn them money, right? So, you know, they can install their kiosk software in a computer they got at their shop or video store or whatever, and all of a sudden, bang, you know, it's...
The sales pitch is turn your old unwanted computer into revenue.
Yeah, yeah. It's a pretty convincing pitch, right?
Yeah, totally. So these things are sold as like $50, $99 shareware products. Mm. Download it online, enter a registration key, and you've got a fully functional kiosk. Now, the kiosk software itself implements its own security. It's another sales pitch they use, is that you require no additional security or hardening on these boxes. You run our software, and that's it. Everything is secure. So the software is designed to stop users coming along and escaping the kiosk software and trying to browse the file system, accessing native OS functionality, or like browsing the network, or executing programs, downloading things, changing the background, stuff like that.
Fun stuff.
Yeah, fun stuff, yeah. So I downloaded about 10 of the most common or most popular kiosk software products. There are over 40 available in the commercial market. I set these up in virtual machines, and I began penetration testing, each of these products, trying to find vulnerabilities. I wanted to find some zero-day, I wanted to find some tricks and some exploits. As I sort of tested all these products in their VMs, I found that the kiosk software security model really doesn't trust the user on a keyboard, right? So, you know, although you can do some of these tricks like typing in a URL to try and access the file system, a lot of the times you don't actually have a URL entry bar. You know, the kiosk software is designed to not trust the dude who's at the kiosk.
Mm.
So that left the only other real attack vector I could think of, which was having a remote website which could attack a kiosk for you or attack yourself at the kiosk. So I designed something which I called ICAT, which is the Interactive Kiosk Attack Tool. Now, I did demo an earlier version of this at KiwiCon last year, but I've been researching and working on this like 2 or 3 days a week. since KiwiCon, and it's grown quite a lot now. So.
Well, I can imagine it would have, Paul.
Yeah, so the idea is basically using browser-based functionality to escape kiosk software. So can I use different plugins in the browser? Can I use Flash? Can I use JavaScript, ActiveX, Java? Can I use ClickOnce, which is the .NET deployment application? Can I use other URI handlers? Can I use other protocols, other file types? Basically, what I've done is I've designed an attack tool or an attack service, as I call it, which is free to use, which will allow you to compromise a kiosk in 1 to 1.5 minutes.
Okay, now, the obvious question here, Paul, is why would you bother compromising a kiosk? What is it going to get you as an attacker?
Okay, all right. So kiosks pop up in many different places. I mean, firstly, you get your average kiosks, like internet kiosk terminals in your airports, your hotels, motels, things like that. Now, if someone's using these, or if travelers are using these to check bank accounts, check websites, you could potentially install a keylogger, start stuffing lots of interesting information from the box. A lot of this kiosk software, because it's quite intrusive in the OS, has to be ran as a privileged user. So if you can escape kiosk software or compromise kiosk software, you actually end up with an admin account.
So you can basically, you're going to wind up with a pretty decent bot.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's another idea I had. You could go on a holiday, you know, go glow tripping and build a botnet out of all the kiosks you compromise in different airports.
I guess your idea of a holiday is a little bit different to mine.
Right. But you could walk into an airport, let's say an airport in Asia, which has lots of kiosks, and hack every single kiosk. Now, what information do you think you would see passing through an airport, an entire airport?
Well, you're going to get a fairly wide cross section, I'd imagine.
Yeah, you get everything that's going through the kiosk network. The other places you find kiosks are things like corporate lobbies. So a lot of companies, especially in New Zealand, have a kiosk in their front lobby with a sign saying something like, "Well, you know, come surf our website, look at our phone directory that's available online, all through our internet kiosk terminal."
And I bet you they don't bother putting that on its own VLAN, do they?
No, a lot of them are plugged straight into the corporate network, and they're also accessible without any sort of identification cards. So you don't need to, like, sign into the company, like sign in register book thing, to be able to use the kiosk. The kiosk is in a public place, using the front. So you dress up in a shirt, pair of pants, maybe a tie, you go down, you start using the kiosk, no one will ask you any questions. You have 5, maybe 10 minutes. You visit ICAT, my website, you hack, compromise the kiosk, you now have a desktop on the internal LAN, probably running as administrator user. You then start attacking internal services.
Now,
you could hack the entire network without, you know, without having to get into the building.
Now, I've got to ask, you know, you do penetration testing as part of your job, right?
Yes.
Have you actually had occasion to use ICAT in a pen test in a real-world situation?
Yes.
You have?
Yes, and it's been very successful.
Mm-mm-mm. So can you walk us through that attack?
Sure. So the concept of ICAT is basically trying to invoke functionality on the kiosk. Kiosk software works by trying to lock down what you can do. So you can only browse the internet. My software basically goes in and tries lots of different dynamic approaches of popping up applications and spawning things in the background using browser components. So basically what I was able to do was spawn some applications which allowed me to then access the file system. I could access the file system, spawn cmd.exe, I then use taskkill to kill the kiosk process, restart Explorer, and then I'm basically left at the desktop.
Great. So that was a kiosk in someone's lobby, was it?
That was a kiosk in someone's lobby, yeah.
And then what, you used your shell access to that box to propagate your attack through their corporate LAN, or...?
Yeah, I'm not going to go into detail. Yeah, there were other things, shall we say, in the network that I can mess with. But essentially, once I had a terminal, it's sky's the limit. You have an open network jack or an open jack into someone's network. You can, you know, run up Canvas and just say, you know, start hacking.
Go nuts, yeah.
Yeah, very, very easy. I mean, sky's the limit once you're in. It's just getting in. And actually getting in took, man, 3-4 minutes. It was very, very fast. Very easy.
So I guess really the moral of the story is if you're going to have a kiosk in your lobby, you're going to want to make damn sure it's on its own VLAN.
Yeah, you want to make damn sure it's on its own VLAN and also secured. I mean, what I found is, although my software is very good at sort of attacking this kiosk, attacking different kiosk products, the kiosks themselves are actually very configurable. You can configure a kiosk so that it is secure. But in order to do that, you really have to sort of use a pen testing tool. To be able to do that.
And not many people running a Ma and Pa coffee shop with a kiosk are going to really bother with that, are they?
No, they're probably not going to bother with it, and they're going to get pwned. I mean, yeah.
Look, one of the points you made in your original presentation at KiwiCon is that, you know, dumb mouth-breathing users tend to use their same password for their Hotmail account as they would for their corporate VPN. So, you know, that's bad. Because once you've pwned, you know, keystrokes through a kiosk, you might then be able to turn that into a quote-unquote real attack. Is that right?
So a lot of people have the perception that if you're using an internet kiosk terminal or a public internet access, you should only access untrusted information resources, things like, well, checking your webmail, for example. You know, like, it's my webmail. That's nothing. That's not my bank account. That's not anything like that. But maybe by accessing your webmail, the same password you use for something else, and I can find that resource and access that. Maybe, like, as you said, the VPN password. A lot of companies authenticate webmail passwords from the same AD that they authenticate VPN passwords from.
Well, it's a good argument for two-factor, isn't it, and one-time password?
Yeah, pretty much. And it's also a good factor for not using public internet access terminals.
Yeah, but people, you know, man, come on, I've been bored enough in a bloody airport to use one, you know, and I know that it's dodgy.
Yeah, but this is the sort of eye-opening thing.
So, Paul, why did you choose to actually launch this at DEF CON?
Well, I mean, I've been working on this for quite a while, and I wanted to have like an official release or an official. I just wanted to go to a conference, talk in front of some hackers, and show them how to hack kiosks, basically.
Well, that's pretty simple motivation. Don't you anticipate, though, that the first thing that kiosk software manufacturers are going to do is block the ICAT URL?
Sure. What I'm doing is I'm making the software open source and available. It's actually going to be portable available.
So I can go put it on IT Radio.
Yeah, totally. You can download a copy and put it on your own website. All the tools that I've written a lot of kiosk exploitation tools which run on a kiosk and do various things for you. These will all be open source, so you can then modify it, port it, do different things to it. It's going to be very, very widespread.
Paul Craig, thank you very much for taking some time out to speak to Risky Business. We look forward to hacking a kiosk with your tools soon.
Yeah, no worries, man. Thank you very much for having me.
Paul Craig from New Zealand talking about ICAT. And you can find ICAT at ikat.ha.ckeed.net. Next up, it's time to speak with our regular sponsor guest, Marcus J. Renham. His hobbies, according to Wikipedia, include photography and firearms. Marcus is credited with writing the Digital Equipment Corporation's SEAL firewall in 1990. He founded Network Flight Recorder in 1997, invented the internal combustion engine, nuclear fission, chocolate and puppies. Well, maybe not the last few, but Marcus has been kicking around in security for something like 20 years and has achieved a lot in that time. I think of him as our very own resident security Yoda, but more cynical than Yoda, obviously. And he joins us now to talk about PCI.
I'm not a cynic, I'm a realist.
That's what all cynics say. So, yes. PCI, do you think it has done anything for the security of, merchants who handle credit card information?
Oh, I think absolutely, which is probably not what you expected me to say. PCI has been probably the most important event in the history of computer security as far as, you know, actually causing things to happen. You know, we had things like the Morris worm, which everybody remembers, but not many people actually did anything as a result of it. And what PCI is actually causing people to do is to look and go back and actually do stuff that they should have been doing for decades already.
What I think is really funny is, you know, you're not alone in applauding PCI for actually having done something, but there's this really weird attitude that is you know, quite prevalent, particularly in the United States, which is a really anti-government regulation sort of attitude. Yet when you see, you know, the private sector come in and basically do the same thing, everyone jumps up and down and claps and says, yeah, it's really good. What is with that?
Well, you know, I think that what's really, it's very simple, and this probably applies to you as well. I think most of us seriously doubt the government's competence, and most of us realize that, you know, if the government actually tried to do something like PCI, what they would have done is they would have, you know, they would have had a gigantic lobbying wank fest, and by the time it was all over, they would have wound up with something like PCI, except you'd have to buy one of a product from certain lists of vendors who had paid lobbyists, yada yada. Right, you can see how that kind of disaster would play itself out.
I get it. It's sort of, now it looks like the so what you're talking about there is the EAL certifications.
Exactly. And so what happened with PCI is basically a bunch of people who really actually knew what they were doing didn't ask anybody. They just said, okay, you know, here's the rules. And everybody said, oh, okay, because you're the customer in this case, and you're always right, and you get to make these rules, or else we have to spend lots of money. Badoonch, it's just happened. It's been amazing.
Yeah, so you think it's actually had a tangible impact?
I think it's had a tangible impact. I think, you know, a lot of what we're seeing is the obvious question is it making everything more secure? I'm not sure about that. I think it's causing a lot of organizations to reassess existing practices, and in many, 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 many cases, these organizations basically had no practices at all. Mm. So the net effect of telling people, you know, hey, keep your system logs and actually look at them, I mean, there's no way you can lose by doing that.
And stop storing credit card numbers in clear text. Or
yeah,
at all,
you know,
indeed.
No more of that. And, you know, separate your critical networks from your uncritical networks. Ooh, great idea. I know people have been talking about that for 25 years.
Yeah, it is interesting seeing, I mean, you're right, you know, having rules mandated, and some of them are pretty basic, but the one that I like is if you want to connect your LAN through a static, you know, VPN to your production environment, then your LAN falls under scope for PCI assessment. And that, you know, I thought about that, and I thought, oh, okay, that's pretty cool. So people who want to, you know, SSH into their production environment now, even to SSH in, they need two-factor.
And that is transitive trust, right? So I mean, my hats are off to the PC, my hat's off to the PCI guys. I wear more than one hat, so they're all off. But, you know, my hat's off to the PCI guys, because what they're actually doing is they've brought transitive trust into the scope. They're saying, if you're going to do remote administration, you have to take into account that you know, hackers could be doing remote administration over your remote administration channel. You have to address that. This is a great thing. So there's a lot of stuff in there that's really good. Now, the place where I'm a little bit skeptical is that the cost of backfitting all this stuff that should have been being done all along has been staggering for a lot of organizations.
Well, that's been the best thing that ever happened to, I mean, web application auditing as a sole business model for a, you know, security outfit didn't really exist until PCI came along. It spurned a whole new industry.
Right. Right. And the other thing that it did is it made a lot of organizations suddenly go, what? You mean our web guys, when they told us it was okay, they didn't know what they were talking about?
Yeah.
You know, I've had to clean up on a couple of these kinds of situations. And you know, what happens is you get this bizarre kind of security disaster scenario where senior management feel that it's been lied to by the technical staff who told them that it was all okay. And then the security people feel that their advice has been ignored. And what's actually happened is that there's been a mismatch of expectations that happens kind of in a middle management level. And I think PCI has done a tremendous amount to force organizations to encounter that expectations mismatch.
This really would have helped ramp up sales for companies like Tenable, though. So you could see that some may say you're a little bit biased in saying this.
Well, it's certainly caused an upsurge in spending in some areas, and it's caused a down surge in spending in others. It's just like any other major industry event. Some people have come out a little bit better. Some people have come out a little bit worse.
Who's come off worse, and why?
Well, I think that the people who are really coming off badly are the small players who really don't have a credible story that their stuff is good. And they're finding themselves locked out now by essentially the nobody ever lost their job for buying IBM kind of play.
Yeah. So the really small companies providing point solutions are finding it difficult to get a foothold, are they?
Yeah, and it's not just the point solution guys. It would be the innovators as well, right? I mean, there's, you know, right now the entire industry has just turned in and it's gazing at its navel to see if its navel is compliant. And the people who are actually out there trying to come up with new ideas and maybe break new ground, the industry isn't interested in new ground right now. They're interested in retrofitting all this stuff that they should have done 15 years ago.
And making sure it's certified. You know, and I notice that, you know, you can find these really shit-hot security guys, but they're not PCI certified. And, you know, I wonder if there's a danger with these, you know, PCI qualified security assessor type things that we're going to wind up with a bunch of tie-pins. I don't know if you're familiar with that term, but if you're going to wind up with a bunch of tie-pins who really don't know what they're doing, but because they're a PCI QSA, they can sign off and, you know, we're back to the whole CISP problem.
Right. Well, that's one place where I can definitely wave my curmudgeon flag. I mean, I've been saying for a very long time that certification in general is an excuse for being lazy and ignorant on the part of the customer, right? Because basically what you're doing is you're saying, I'm not actually going to understand what you do. I'm going to just look and see if you've got the correct alphabet soup at the end of your name. And the premise there is that somebody else understands what you do.
Yeah.
But essentially the idea of hiring somebody just because they're certified is that you're doing this so that you can remain utterly blissfully ignorant about what they're supposed to be doing, which if you think about that for half a second is just never going to work.
Now, Marcus, I agree with you, but the problem with the PCI scheme is that when you hire people to do work on your sort of PCI certification to get them to sign off on an audit or whatever, they have to be PCI certified.
Right. Right, and that's a big problem. And this goes, you know, this goes all over the place. I mean, you know, one of my buddies and I a couple of years ago did a really, really interesting piece of work in system log collection analysis. So we built this homebrew system that you know still today does stuff that a lot of the commercial offerings can't do because of performance problems, and. Of course, their auditors came in and said, oh, you can't have a homebrew solution here. You have to go buy a product because we don't understand homebrew solutions. We understand products that come from any of this list of vendors. So why don't you go spend $500,000 on one of those instead of your free thing that actually works, and then we can certify you.
Yeah, well, I mean, I've seen some of the most impressive setups I've ever seen have all been custom, you know, relying on a combination of things like MRTG for graphing and like just all these little Linux script sort of ideas that when cobbled together can provide you with some pretty sophisticated monitoring.
Well, you know, the important thing, I'm sensing a thread here. It kind of comes back to the same issue as the certification. When you're building your own thing, you actually have to understand what you're trying to accomplish in order to build it. Right? And if you understand what you're trying to accomplish, and of course you succeed in accomplishing it, you're actually way far ahead of the guy who doesn't understand what he's trying to accomplish. He just understands that he needs to go and buy a hey diddle from one of this list of preferred vendors and pay a consultant a large amount of money to set it up and then get the hey diddle report once a week.
Well, the great irony here is that, you know, PCI mandates all of that sort of idiocy, and yet we're seeing an improvement in the level of security of merchants.
Yeah, because actually, and here's the part that sucks, okay? Idiocy is a huge step forward for the industry.
What, mandating just some sort of action, you mean, whatever it is?
Yeah, I mean, idiocy is a gigantic improvement. Most of the industry was not anywhere near as good as being idiotic.
Where was it? Just stupefied, sort of comatose, or
completely asleep at the switch. I mean, you still hear about, you know, these ridiculous things, and well, of course, PCI and government security don't really cross, fortunately for government agencies, because they would all be immediately decertified. But I mean, the state of the art is really not very good.
Mm.
I was involved in a case 2 years ago with a banking application. You want to talk about, you know, safe web development and stuff like that. This was a banking application that was fielded at a number of major banks. There was not even any revision control or bug tracking in use by the developers who were doing this thing. Essentially, anytime somebody found something that didn't work correctly, They would go into a panic mode, and someone would stay up all night drinking Jolt Cola and issue a patch.
Yeah, see, it's really funny when I hear stories like this from the US, because here in Australia we have four banks. Basically, the finance sector is really heavily regulated in Australia, the banking sector. We've got four major banks and a couple of like slightly smaller ones, but because the banks are so concentrated, they all know what they're doing. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
They're the high security guys. And you talk to the guys who manage the various divisions, a lot of them are like ex-law enforcement and stuff, and they say, well, you know, we're banks, we are security companies, that's what we've always done. You give us some money, we keep it safe. So when I hear all these stories of US banks using like Expression Engine, like with, you know, and these off-the-shelf content management systems with default passwords in them and stuff, it just makes me, it really does boggle my mind.
Well, it's because there are so many different banks. And again, it boils down that somebody someplace in the IT staff decided to take somebody's word for something, right? They turned off their sense of skepticism.
No, it's just it's quite fascinating. But Marcus, look, we're going to have to wrap it up there, mate, but thank you very much for sharing your insights with Risky Business once again.
Oh, my pleasure.
Tenable Network Security's Marcus Ranham there with this week's sponsor interview. And that's it for this week's edition of Risky Business. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.